Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that carries on voting until it gets the result it wants. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, excitingly, listeners, this is our 100th episode. We thought that we'd try and prove Karl Marx's dictum that life repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce. In our first ever episode, we talked about referendums and whether or not they were a useful policy tool. That first episode was recorded before that Brexit, which we have now. And we thought what we'd talk about this time is the idea of the proposal for a second Brexit referendum. So many Remainers are arguing that a second referendum is the best way of stopping Brexit. But are they right? So, Steve, who exactly is arguing for a second referendum?
Effectively, it boils down to diehard Remainers. There are a number of different kind of groupings that are trying to do it. The Lib Dems have been quite vocal about trying to bring about a second referendum. You have elements of the Labour Party, most notably the kind of group around Chakra Amana. And you have your general hardcore Remainers who are on Twitter on that little section of the internet, which is populated by people who put hashtags like follow back pro-European in their profiles and in their names. You do have within the Conservatives a small section of Conservative MPs who would probably be quite all right with the idea of a second referendum, the likes of Anna Salisbury, people who have been identified now as Brexit rebels. But for the most part, they've not necessarily been very vocal about supporting the call for a second referendum, partially because I think they're more focused on trying to influence government policy to make Brexit a bit softer than try and do something which will grab headlines, which is what a lot of the oppositional parties are attempting.
And there's a bit of a difference, I think, isn't there? There's almost two different kinds of second referendum. One of them is that we have a second in or out referendum. Mm-hmm. The other type is a referendum on the terms of the final deal. Either leave the EU on the terms in which it's negotiated by the government, or we stay in the EU.
Yeah, and really, both of those kind of attempts to create a second referendum on those terms all fall back to that kind of that core position of we want to stay in the EU, therefore the best way to achieve this is to ask the people the question again, hoping that we will somehow get a different answer this time round.
We should be fair, I suppose, in that Vernon Bogdanor, who I think was David Cameron's tutor at Oxford and is one of the gurus of the British Constitution, such as it is, he last year made the case for a second Brexit referendum. And in essence, his argument was that after the general election, that proves that there's not a lot of support either in the country or in Parliament for the kind of hard Brexit that Theresa May wanted to follow. Also, both parties are quite internally divided on the issue of Brexit, as you might have noticed. And also that the House of Lords is quite Remainery and will probably reject any move towards a hard Brexit type of deal. Therefore, the only way to break the impasse is by having a referendum.
I am not necessarily convinced by that. I think there are two issues with it, really. One is that actually the 2017 election result, yes, it returned a hung parliament, which means it's very difficult to get a majority for a deal of any kind or for a Brexit position of any kind. But from a democratic mandate perspective, both Labour and the Conservatives ran on Brexit positions, which were, roughly speaking, pro-Brexit. Labour's was very ambiguous, deliberately so, to try and maximise its vote, but it wasn't the Lib Dem position, which was very much very stridently pro-EU and anti-Brexit. Whilst the mathematics in Parliament may be tricky, I think from a democratic standpoint, I don't think that really holds up. And the other side of it, for me, is yes, the House of Lords will kind of dive in and start amending things and do all kinds of stuff to any bills. And yes, there is a time frame, but that time frame to kind of get stuff done is actually just self-imposed. if we turned around to the EU and said, look, we're having problems getting this through, can we please just extend that transition deal a bit longer? I don't think they'd object necessarily, which then brings the Parliament Act into play. Which, given, and again, the commitment of both parties to push through Brexit in some capacity, you can make a strong case that you can utilise the Parliament Act.
I see what you mean about the positions of both parties. I suppose what Bognor cites in his article is the British election survey, I think, which says that Labour's soft Brexit position was quite popular with voters. So, yes, both parties committed to leave. However, as you say, Labour was trying to throw a little bit of soft Brexity Remainy red meat in there as well. I think maybe to add to the argument in favour of a second referendum is that there is a bit of a precedent, a kind of unwritten precedent being in the British Constitution, that we have referendums on constitutional issues. So if, for instance, we were to join the Euro or abolish the monarchy or change the voting system or change the House of Lords, it seems to be generally accepted those kind of things would happen with the support of a referendum, that Parliament couldn't just pass an act and do it on its own.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right with that. There is certainly, or at least we've developed in recent times more than anything else, a notion that constitutional issues do require some form of direct democracy or referendum. The issue is, if you're arguing for a second referendum, you know, it's very easy to say, but we had one of those. So yes, you can make that technical point about, you know, it's going to be a different question. It's not going to be about should we leave. It's going to be about the terms of leaving or whatever. But as long as you've got that option, which is basically, but actually we should just stay, that referendum becomes the exact same referendum we just had. It becomes, should we leave or should we go? And at that point, the electorate switches off because they've already taken that decision. They may not like it. A load of them may not have voted for it and they may not like it, but they will probably support like that cause again, or support the cause as a whole and make sure that we do go.
I think that kind of hits the nail on the head a little bit, in that I don't think politically it's a very wise strategy to go for a second referendum. I can see why they're doing it, because there is that precedent. However, I think it's not a good idea, as you've kind of hinted. People don't like voting twice for the same stuff. Part of the reason I think there was a little bit of a reaction against the Conservatives last June is because people don't like being asked to vote in unnecessary elections. And there's other examples of snap elections like the Heath one in 1974. There's still enough of a consensus that we did have a vote and that result does matter.
Mm-hmm. I think, to be honest, the notion that a lot of the Remain supporters who are making these arguments are kind of focusing on is a bit baseless. Like, they seem to think that just by the situation will have changed, it will be self-evident that Britain will be better off inside the EU compared to being out of it by the time of the second referendum, that they'll just be able to sweep back to victory. Even if, and this is a big if from my perspective, you were to hold a vote which would result in Britain staying in the EU, it's still going to be narrow. It's still going to be a very, very narrow result, which just means you end up in a situation where you're just basically, for lack of a better term, pissing off almost 50% of the electorate. Like, this has been a common kind of refrain with the EU from Eurosceptics across Europe, not just in the UK, but across Europe, that what the EU does and what like pro-EU governments do is they ask you the question, and then they keep on asking it again until you give them the right answer. Given the time we are living in, where you have the rise of populist parties like the AfD, Donald Trump, and all of that, that is potentially a very dangerous outcome for us to be aiming for, because it will just further alienate large sections of the public and make them think, actually, no, these guys don't have our interests at heart, or they don't care about democracy. They're only in it for themselves.
I think it was over the Lisbon Treaty, wasn't it? I think France rejected it. I have a feeling that
Ireland did as well.
Yes, and had to rerun those votes, as you say. Ironically, it would have been better for Britain to have a referendum over the Lisbon Treaty. Tony Blair made sure that there wasn't one, but actually,
we'd have probably won that referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. and then we wouldn't be in this position now.
Even if we'd have lost that referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, it's just a way of lancing the boil of Euroscepticism. Mm-hmm. One of the strongest, and I still don't think there should be a second referendum, but one of the strongest reasons for having one is that the British public's knowledge of the EU is more advanced than it was in 2016. I mean, famously, after the referendum, one of the most Googled things was, what is the EU? And almost the history of the last 2 years of the podcast has been us having to research things like Article 50, the single market, the customs union, Euratom, all those things that we didn't talk about in our podcasts before the referendum when we're thinking about how to decide, but are very, very important. And ironically, if we'd have had a referendum over the EU constitution or over the Lisbon Treaty, it would have meant that we could talk about that kind of thing and we could debate that kind of thing, which would mean, okay, even we might not win that referendum, but we'd have had those conversations. Whereas as it is, Cameron having a straight in-out referendum, well, he's just put everything on red and we lost. It goes back to, I think, what Bernard Crick was saying about the importance of politics rather than the importance of democracy. Like, politics is about negotiation and give and take and working out what the best strategy is, which is different to democracy, which can end up being two wolves and a sheep deciding what to eat for dinner.
Yeah, and I think there is a bit of an interesting element of that kind of politics versus democracy thing within the arguments for a second referendum, and that, you know, an awful lot of the people who are saying, oh, it's only fair and right that we give the people a say on this matter, are also the same people that would, a couple of years ago, would have said, no, we don't need to have a referendum on this stuff at all, because, you know, we're a representative democracy. Can't have your cake and eat it. You've got to choose one of those lines. Either you're for referendums as a way to try and actually engage with people and give them a say on how the country is run. There are strong arguments for and against that. Or you're not. And that's, I think, one of the issues that I feel like what grates at me when it comes to like the hardcore Remainers, like AC Grayling, for instance, on Twitter, is that it very much feels like any support they have for direct democracy is just because it might align with their interests rather than it being an actual belief.
Well, and especially with a lot of the comments that he's been making about the referendum not really being legally binding and almost a way of kind of wiggling out. Imagine if Remain had won 52-48 and Cameron said, but it wasn't a binding referendum, so therefore we're going to leave anyway. I mean...
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where I do genuinely feel like the Remainers who are pushing these kind of lines, you do need to take a step back and realise that they aren't actually making a case at all for why Britain should stay in the EU, given we've already had this vote. The case that should be being made, and to be fair to like Chukwumana and a load of the figures within Labour, they're focused on trying to make it a bit more of a soft Brexit. Soft Brexit, maybe with that option of having that second referendum. But you know, an awful lot of them aren't focused on that. They are just focused on overturning the initial result, which, to do that, you need to be arguing a strong case, and it needs to be stronger than the case you would have had to make last time round, because we've already had this vote. Why should we have it again? What has changed radically? And the answer is actually not that much.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think one of them is that the best way maybe of arguing for it is the Tony Blair approach. And Tony Blair uses the analogy of buying a house and saying that if you were going to buy a house, you would inspect that house first. You wouldn't just kind of get what the estate agent would give you. You go around, you'd inspect it, you see what kind of area it was, and then you decide whether to move from your current house or not. It's a narrative that could work. And in fact, apparently in focus groups does work until you tell them that's Tony Blair's argument, at which point they're kind of switched off. And the other thing, certainly in terms of fighting a second referendum, is a lot of the stuff that's come out since the referendum has been the economic news, which again, economics was always Remain's strongest card. What Leave did in the referendum was neutralise that card by fuzzing the issue, talking about experts, bringing up a silly figure. But the cultural reasons and the more kind of social and political reasons for Leave's win, about people feeling left behind, about people thinking they didn't have control, about immigration, if we're honest, and issues of identity, they haven't been solved. And it's those things that a lot of the Remain campaigners haven't really been engaging with at all.
No. Certainly on the identity front. In fact, they've kind of doubled down in the opposite direction, really, what they need to be doing if they want to make that case. Twitter, I referenced this earlier, you can now, you can search for hashtags like FBPE, mm-hmm. which is Follow Back Pro-European, and hashtag WATON, which is We Are the Opposition Now. Both of those are utilised by the pro-Remain circles on Twitter as a way to identify themselves. They're forming, quite literally, this little community on Twitter, probably through blogs and other channels as well, where they are, you know, engaging with each other. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you start building up a community like that, it becomes exclusionary. Because it creates an in-group and an out-group. And the last thing you want to do if you want to try and persuade 50% of the country that you're right is to be exclusionary. Because here's the thing, I've paid attention to some of the things that are going on those hashtags on Twitter and looking to see what kind of discussions they're having. I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot barge pole. A lot of it does appear to me to be quite loopy. And I'm somebody who voted Remain, is pro-Remain, and I would like, in an ideal world, to not leave the EU. But I don't want to get involved with that group because of how they're handling themselves and the kind of the way that they are engaging with the debate, which is, you know, still quite heavily in a number of areas. All Brexiteers are racists. They were duped. They're dumb, believing what the Leave campaign had said. And it's just like, I don't want to be involved with that. And that's definitely not a way to win a referendum.
It ignores other reasons of why Remain lost and how to win back support. The issue for Remainers that never seems to come up when people are arguing for a second referendum is you could easily lose. And the polling is by no means clear. If anything, Remain was polling better during the referendum campaign 1 or 2 months out mm-hmm. than it is now.
I mean, and there's a very valid reason for that. Is the Leave campaign and Brexiteers did refer to Project Fear. Well, the notion was that that the Remain campaign was trying to scare people into not supporting Brexit. And there was an element of truth to that. A lot of the stats and figures that were thrown out were quite shocking and were very stark. Now, and a number of those predictions, quite legitimately, have not come to pass. There have been some very bad economic indicators which have occurred since the UK voted for Brexit. But it has not been a completely terrible situation across the short term. And that's something that Cameron, Osborne, Clegg and all the others were saying that it would be. Mm. We have not seen a complete and utter exodus of European migrants from the UK. Numbers coming in have dropped and have slowed, absolutely, but there's not been an exodus. We have not seen like a drop-off necessarily in investment to a large degree. In fact, actually, what we've seen is some very high-profile large companies like Google, as an example, making commitments to maintaining their presence in the UK. The picture has not been all rosy by any means, but it's not been as bad as it was originally made out. So when you are told everything's going to be horrible and then it's just a bit middling, you know, you can easily see why people may not kind of then jump on the bandwagon with you to say, actually, this was all an awful, horrible idea.
There's a few different things to unpack there, aren't they? I think one of them is this kind of, certainly on a few of the hashtags you talked about, saying that all leavers were duped by lies, whilst conveniently ignoring the fact that George Osborne put out a punishment budget that would happen if we voted leave with extra cuts.
Yep.
And that Treasury report saying every household would pay an extra £4,000 or something for the cost of Brexit, which is a little bit dodgy,
yep.
to say the least. I think also with that, the impression you get from a lot of those who voted leave is that, yes, they think it's going to be pretty bad in the short term, but in the medium to long term, they think it will be better. Okay. I mean, there's also the fact that a lot of Leave voters seem to think that even if it's really bad in the long term, they still would have voted Leave. But still, I think there's this idea that, well, we'll have a short-term pain for a long-term gain. A very five-year plan, almost. But I kind of take issue slightly that hasn't been... I mean, yes, there hasn't been a Brexit as such. However, say stuff like nursing applications have declined and net migration's falling below 100,000 for the first time.
Absolutely, there are negatives. Do not get me wrong. but the image that was presented was, and I'm not like exaggerating too much here, especially when you mention the things like Osborne's punishment budget, they were almost apocalyptic. It was like the end of Britain, almost, or like the end of Britain as we know it today, if Britain voted for Brexit. And that hasn't happened in the short term, which, you know, don't get me wrong, I still think that leaving the EU is going to be bad for the British economy over the medium to the long term, but you can't be surprised that people don't buy into your scaremongering now, or your kind of your arguments, whether they be evidence-based or not, about what the economy is going to be like in the medium to long term, when it was overblown in the short term as well.
And the impression you get as well is that a lot of the practical problems with implementing Brexit itself, which we've talked on about on the podcast, like what we're going to do about flights, what we're going to do about customs checks, what we're going to do about Euratom and all that, the attitude seems to be a bit like a kind of the Dan Hannan, Pangloss attitude, oh, we'll work something out. And therefore, I don't think we'll see a massive shift in favour of staying in the EU or not leaving, unless Britain does crash out without a deal, if flights are grounded and we do have those customs checks. The thing is, I still don't think that's likely. If we're going to war game Brexit out, I still think it's more likely that Britain enters a soft Brexit basically out of desperation. We'll get to February, March, we won't have a deal, so we end up joining the EEA. Or the government, as seems to be happening this week, asks for the transition deal to be an indefinite period, which ends up being fossilized into something more permanent. I have a feeling that that might happen. So rather than we stay in through a referendum, I think what's more likely is just practical policy dictates that we end up with a softer Brexit because the alternative is terrible. I don't know if you're that optimistic. I get the impression you feel like no deal is more likely than that.
I think that the parliamentary arithmetic that the Tories have to deal with makes it more likely than I think you're considering that we will end up crashing out. I don't disagree with you that until you see that plane's grounded or another significant drop off in the value of the pound or some other kind of massive negative indicators for the British economy that are stark and obvious, because here's the thing, yes, growth has slowed and the growth of Britain is weaker than a lot of the rest of the world and Europe. But until it's something stark, and I'm talking a Black Wednesday type situation, I don't think you're going to get much shifts or movements. And I do think that because you've got that European reform group headed up by Jacob Rees-Mogg on the Tory party benches, who are all hardline Brexiters, there's about 60 of those people. That's enough potentially to cause some serious trouble for May. And what we've seen from Theresa May is that she's not very good at managing her party. She has put off already a number of votes on the state of Brexit and the European Union and our relationship with the European Union. And she's put off another one recently, which is now going to happen some point towards the end of March, I think, which is on the customs union and kind of like what that's going to look like, or our relationship with that is going to look like, because she doesn't think she's got the votes. And if she keeps on doing that, then because she's concerned about what that means for her leadership, and because there's that constant threat of those 60-odd people, which is more than enough to trigger a leadership ballot, that's what drives us over the edge into a hard Brexit, crashing out of everything, because she cannot take the decision that needs to be made.
I think the parliament, 62 MPs, yes, it's enough to bring down May, but it's not enough to prevent Britain staying in the customs union if Labour supports customs union membership and brings on rebel Tory MPs on side.
Absolutely. But then we have the wonderful scenario where those rebels bring down May anyway, at which point you have a new election, at which point a Brexiteer of some description probably gets in. And maybe they've, in order to win that election to become the leader and prime minister, they've promised that we're not going to do that. We won't go into that customs union, even though Parliament's, you know, voted on it. That is something that could also equally happen as a way to, for someone to try and, you know, wrangle their way into being PM. It's the exact sort of shifty crap that someone like Gavin Williamson or Jeremy Hunt would pull.
Now that you've talked about the prospect of a new general election in the next 6 months, We're going to have to stop because I'm going to go and lie down in the darkened room. We will no doubt talk about the prospect of a third or a fourth or even a fifth Brexit referendum on our 150th podcast or our 200th podcast. You can listen to the other 99 or so on iTunes or on our website, notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. My Twitter handle is paperbackwriter.
Mine's @centerradical.
Happy plotting.